And it's Ari Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's subject, we're going to talk about the better choices for 401k plan provisions. Really, my two cents about what plan provisions should be in 401k plan documents, kind of, just detailing what I like to do when I draft plan documents, and which is kind of appropriate now since the Cycle 3 restatement process has begun. But of course, first things first, let's talk about some of the events that are coming up. On Thursday, December the 10th, we're going to have Thursday, December 17th, we're going to have that 401k virtual bunch with Dan Harding, who will talk to us. Dan is someone who worked for TPAs. I think it's a family TPA business, but through Wealth Prime is offering a solution in terms of software that will blow your mind when it comes to plan design and prospecting, and the idea that you have to wait days and days for an actuary to come out with a new comparability study or a defined benefit study. Someone with little bit of education can figure it all out in this handy dandy software and planning to prospective clients. I think it's just something that's just wow. Then on Friday, December the 18th at 401k virtual conference number 9, 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, 2 hours of a lot of fun and information. The JM auditing group will be part of it. I'll be there, and there'll be other providers as well. And then, of course, on January 21 and 22, at 401k National Virtual Conference, Walt Frazier, Doc Gooden, the Retireholics, just signing up, $33.33. To me, a really great two-day event, a lot of memories, and, of course, for all attendees, if you miss a minute here and there, you will have the videos up for you. Recorded on Zoom in case you meet, you gotta go to the restroom, you gotta have a meeting, whatever it is, so you'll never miss it because it'll be available for video. And of course, go to that 401ksite.com for further information. Also, the Minnesota Twins have provided me the date for our makeup conference. It's Friday, June 11th, 2021. I assume by that time there'll be herd immunity thanks to this little vaccine, which we all hopefully will get by April. So I think that June 11th will be the first that 401k live event since the Orlando event from last year. So website's going to be up soon with updated information. And we hope that you can meet us at Target Field. There'll be a game that night. I forget who it will be. I think when we originally scheduled back in June 2020, it was going to be the Angels. I don't know even who it's now. But a lot of fun. Been dying to go to Minnesota, so hopefully we'll be there in June. And then we'll talk about rescheduling the other events, Houston, St. Louis, as well as further events. I mean, the further we get through this and go through herd immunity with a vaccine and whatnot, hopefully, we will be back live in 2021. So let's go back to the topic at hand. Now, I've been drafting plan documents for 22 years, and a lot of what I like is based on what I was taught originally by March Tracy, who was the paralegal that I work with when I first started working in this business. But a lot of it, of course, is also time. Working for TPAs and not working for TPAs. This is just basically, my opinion and my opinion only. So therefore, if people have a difference of opinion, it's an opinion. I don't get I'm not disheartened when I hear an opinion that's different. Number one, eligibility. In an ideal world, we'd have no eligibility requirements for 401k plans, but we don't live in an ideal world. And the fact of the matter is that, an employer, based on the demographics of their business, may want to keep out part-timers from receiving an employer contribution. We know the long-time part-time employee exclusion the change for salary deferrals that will require coverage for these employees in 2024. But, a lot of plan sponsors don't want to have immediate eligibility, especially if they have a high turnover rate. A short eligibility requirement is just going to create too many former participants with small account balances, which could create an administrative burden, which could cause a requirement for a plan audit, as well as, it's just a headache in dealing with so many different little accounts. As far as entry dates, in my two cents, I don't mind dual entry. I like first day of the quarter, plan your quarter. First day of the month is fine. I never like immediate. Immediate entry is the absolute dumbest idea. And the reason I think it's the dumbest idea is because you're going, let's say, for example, if you're going to go for dual entry, that means you have two entry dates. Two entry dates where you have to record keep and make sure that the people that are eligible will enter the plan. If you go to immediate entry, you're essentially looking at almost 260 business days and determining that a person enters the plan on a specific date. So I just think that it's idiotic by having immediate entry. Monthly is fine. Quarterly is probably better, just four dates instead of 12. Just because when we're dealing with entry dates and we forget people who are eligible to participate and we don't allow them the opportunity to defer, we have a missed deferral opportunity, we have a lot of administrative headaches. So in my mind, monthly or quarterly are fine, dual is still fine. I like quarterly because it's the best of both worlds. It allows people to enter on a plan year quarter. It's four is more than two, but it's not 12. So it's just my two cents. Next on my list is matching contributions, and whether you decide to make contributions or not, I recommend having a discretionary matching provision. You know, I've seen too many plan sponsors over the past who, don't want to ever have a matching contribution and don't include it in their plan, and I always say, you know what, always have a discretionary matching provision because I've had plan sponsors that didn't want to do it, then all of a sudden they wanted to have a matching provision, and then you have the whole trouble of basically having to restate the plan document because you really can't amend a plan and add a matching contribution because you have so much language with ACP tests and all that stuff. So I recommend creating a discretionary matching contribution. And the problem a lot of plan sponsors do is they handcuff themselves by creating a stated matching provision in their plan document. So they're essentially taking a contribution that can be stationary and discretionary and make it required as long as you don't amend it. You know, to me, you know, I've dealt with 22 years, as an ERISA attorney. I've seen plenty of lean times in this business where employers would have to go and amend their matching contribution formula when they had a stated match, and having to exclude it out, and then worrying whether they're going to have any accrual issues and whatnot, and a whole host of other problems. And I just feel like if you keep it discretionary with a contribution notice, it's fine. So when lead times are lean, you can just simply make a statement and say, we're not going to make a matching contribution for the year. It's just my two cents. Less is more. And why handcuff yourself by essentially making, through a stated contribution, you're essentially making the 401k plan into a pension plan, essentially, with a mandated contribution. When dealing with profit-sharing contributions, as I always say, a business, of course, doesn't need to have a profit to make a profit-sharing contribution. Profit-sharing contributions can be made pro rata, integrated with Social Security. It could also be done through a point system, age-weighted or cross-tested allocation. Of course, most plan sponsors use that, pro rata, comp-to-comp, contribution. Or, of course, they may use a cross-tested where you're separating people into, individually or by groups and giving the higher-paid people the opportunity to get a greater contribution as long as they meet the minimum gateway requirements for your non-highly compensated employees. As far as a safe harbor contribution, everybody knows that allows the plan sponsors to make a fully vested contribution in the form of a matching or a profit-sharing contribution to plan participants. So by doing so, the employer is deemed to satisfy the deferral and matching, you know, discrimination test, the ADP-ACP, as well as satisfying top-heavy. Safe harbor contribution is used by employers that have failed discrimination testing in the past or on the verge of failing. Because of employer demographics that would create a discriminatory feature in favor of the highly compensated employees. But a safe harbor contribution is not for everybody. An employer doesn't need one if they consistently pass the discrimination test with flying colors. I do love the safe harbor profit sharing contribution a lot more than I like match. And the reason I like it is because in conjunction with cross-tested, it's beautiful. You can use the safe harbor contribution, that 3% non-elective, and use the satisfy minimum gateway, which would give the highly compensated employees about 9% of contributions. So I like it. I always like safe harbor plans. But of course, for the employers that really need it and could afford it, of course. As far as vesting, I worked at one firm where it was 100% full vesting. One of the few good things about that law firm. But most employers want to require some service participants to be fully vested in employer contributions. Most employers offer a 6-year graded schedule. Few will offer, you know, immediate 100% vesting. And of course, most employers have vesting schedules that are in between. The decision of which vesting schedule you use is dependent on employer contributions you make as well as turnover. Participants who don't fully satisfy the vesting schedule will forfeit employer contributions. That you, of course, can be reallocated to other participants, pay administrative expenses, or to use to reduce future employer contributions. For most plans that I've worked with, you know, I use the 6-year graded schedule or, you know, a variance of the 20% per year, 5-year schedule, the 25% per year, 4-year schedule. Of course, for some time, the 7-year graded schedule has been disallowed, no longer part. And if you go prior to Tax Reform Act of 86, you'll see some crazy schedules. 10-year graded. I think when ERISA started, there was a 20-year schedule. It's really amazing to see how far we've come in terms of very generous vesting schedules. As far as norm retirement age, I always believe that you should draft plain documents with the concept of keep it simple, stupid. So for normal retirement age, I use age 65. Some plan sponsors may use the later of age 65 or the 5th anniversary of joining the plan. Unless you're hiring people in their late 50s or early 60s, there's no need to use the anniversary date of joining the plan. I just don't like it. 65, keep it simple, stupid. Attaining normal retirement age, of course, makes a participant fully vested, regardless of, you know, how long they've been at the firm. Making someone fully vested at age 65 who may have a few years left in, you know, vesting schedule to me isn't a game changer. So if they joined your firm at age 60, they have a 6-year graded schedule, they're now age 65, okay, so you gave them a free year of vesting. Whoopee. As far as in-service distributions, I like allowing for in-service distributions for participants who retain age 59 and a half. If these plan participants want to start receiving distributions or move the money to an IRA, it's something I'd allow if they, you know, attain NRA, normal retirement age. I like in-service. Somebody attains 59 and a half, somebody attains normal retirement age. Let them access their money. They're, you know, closing in on retirement. I just find it an attractive feature. They want to move it to an IRA, you know, let them. It's their money. As far as hardship, that is really, you know, an employer's call. I'm a softie. when it comes to my kids, and I guess when it comes to plan participants. And I like hardship. If people have an emergency need for money, they should have the opportunity to access their money when they need it. Just my two cents. As far as loans, you know, the loan provision, it's something that I would allow. Of course, it allows participants to borrow against their account balance as a direct investment, where the loan accrues interest and payroll checks are used to pay back the loans within a maximum of 5 years, 30 years for resident loans. You know, plan sponsors don't want loans because the headaches that come with it. I understand that. But you can minimize the headaches through your loan provision by requiring a minimum loan of $1,000. I like minimum loans of $1,000. You're not some type of, you know, as a plan sponsor, you're not some type of check day loan company. If people need money, let them ask for intervals of $1,000. But more importantly, only allow one loan outstanding at a time. Nothing worse for an employer to have 7 or 8 loans outstanding, the TPA forgetting to pay off one loan, and you have a defaulted loan. It's a recipe for disaster, just my two cents. You know, and I've had clients with that problem. And nothing worse to see a company with, you know, participants with 8 loans outstanding. It's just ridiculous and just an absolute disaster. As far as last but not least, forms of payment, while the DOL is interested in annuities, I believe that the only forms that are available should be lump sum or partial withdrawals. Don't deal with installments, don't deal with annuities. Just have people take out a lump sum or partial withdrawals in case they need to satisfy the minimum distribution requirements, or they want to start taking out a couple of bucks here and there. I just think annuities, it's just not my cup of tea, and it probably never will. So we hope you enjoy this shortened episode of that 401k podcast. Of course, that 401k National Virtual Conference, January 21-22. Please go to that 401ksite.com for further information and to sign up for $33.33. Thanks. Bye.